The unity for which we sigh will never come through hate or lie. Love breaks the walls of gender, class, and age. Love gives us wings to slip the bars of every cage. Just a reminder, our next forum program is a month from today, on April 13, here in Chan Chun Hall. Professor Kevin Duran from the University of Colorado Renewable and Sustainable Energy Institute will be with us. He's an attorney and an authority on international environmental law. He'll be presenting Governing the Global Commons, International Environmental Law. And looking a little further ahead, some of you may know the Association of Adventist Forums is holding their annual meeting this year in Chattanooga, Tennessee. It's the second weekend in September, the weekend after the Labor Day weekend. And their topic for the weekend is A Third Way Beyond the Conservative-Liberal Divide to a Christian Identity Refreshed by Interfaith Dialogue. And they have three featured participants: Brian McLaren, who is a leading figure in the emerging church movement and post-evangelical thought; Samir Salmanovic, who is an Andrews University graduate who founded and directs Faith House Manhattan. It's an interfaith ministry in New York City, promoting understanding and fellowship between the world religions; and William Johnson, who is former editor of the Adventist Review. So it should be an interesting weekend. Again, if some of you aren't getting an email notification, there's a sheet in the back if you want to sign up for that. And we thank Terry and Debbie for their parts in publicity. Also thank Daryl Legault and Jim Harris for helping with the sound and recording the program for our website. Both Daryl and Jim were here Sunday afternoon for quite a while working out all the electronics for our panel discussion, and Daryl's running the equipment today, so we thank you. Well, today's presentation, Exclusion and Embrace, Theological Exploration of Identity, Otherness, and Reconciliation. As I mentioned, it'll consist of a series of short presentations and a panel discussion. This is based on a book by Miroslav Volf, who wrote a book by the same title. Dr. Jovanovic will be kind of coordinating things and be introducing those who are working with him here. They're all honor students here at Andrews, and they've all studied through this book together. Ante is an assistant professor of religion, joined the faculty in 2006, teaches systematic theology and ethics. Prior to coming to Andrews faculty, he was a pastor in the Illinois Conference. Born in Yugoslavia, following service in the Yugoslav Army, he began his theological training at Adriatic Union College in Croatia and then at Helderberg College in South Africa. Received an MA in theology from Stellenbosch University in South Africa, and I guess liked studying so much that he came to the U.S. and pursued a doctorate, which he completed at the University of Chicago Divinity School. And his current research interest focuses on the broader questions of religion and violence, the nature of Christian apocalyptic, and the relationship of ethics and aesthetics. So we thank you and all of you on the panel for coming and sharing with us, and we're anxious to hear what you have to say.
Well, I'm deeply grateful to Gary Gray for offering me this opportunity, me and my students, to participate in this event. Having himself read Miroslav Volf's Exclusion and Embrace, and upon finding out that I had been using it as a text in one of my classes, Gary suggested the possibility of exploring the book in this setting. I readily assented to such a proposal, not only because this is one of the more important theological texts of the 20th century, but also because I felt, from my side anyway, that that would be a good way to pay tribute to my thinking theologically students, who over the last couple of years have been engaging this work with serious deliberation and attention. Teaching that upper division course, Capstone Honors course, I should add, has been one of the highlights of my teaching career and has made me certainly a better teacher, and I would also suggest a better scholar. As you might be aware, Wolf is a Christian theologian, a Croatian theologian, teaching at Yale Divinity School. In addition to his books and numerous articles, in 2003, he founded the Yale Center for Faith and Culture, which over the years has sponsored several initiatives centered around major themes such as God and human flourishing, faith and globalization, ethics and spirituality in the workplace, and adolescent faith and flourishing. These areas of exploration aptly illustrate the focus of Wolf's theological research, one that sort of operates on the intersection between theology, philosophy, ethics, sociology, and cultural studies. The book itself, published in 1999 by Abingdon Press, has generated much discussion in the ensuing years. Much of what Wolf articulates there is really not new. Many other people have said this before him. But the reason this book struck such a chord is because it's, I guess, the timeliness of its publication, its comprehensiveness, the multiplicity of interwoven themes that he's addressing, and its rootedness in personal experience, most notably the war in the former Yugoslavia of the 1990s. The book engages the following questions and many others deftly and eruditely. What is forgiveness? How do we forgive? What is the relationship of justice and forgiveness? What is the function of memories, especially memories of wrongdoings received? What are the conditions under which we can let go of them? Are victims ever completely innocent? Is knowledge simply a matter of power and production? In what way has modernity been complicitous in fostering the horrendous violence of the 20th century? Is interreligious dialogue really a solution to the problem of religious violence? Does the book of Revelation present an outburst of resentment, as some postmodern philosophers suggest, a revengeful violence of the weak? What is the role of divine violence? And so on. The central optic that defines the book is the category, as you can see from the title, the category of embrace, which in turn is marked by two distinct stances. Acting, number one, with generosity toward the perpetrator, and second, rethinking the nature of difference. On his count, peaceable boundaries between communities and people should be porous, allowing traffic to go back and forth between the self and multiple others. The result is sort of a discrete but nonetheless fluid sense of identity that Wolf wishes to articulate that adequately accounts for who human beings are in their interchanges. Thus, Wolf's contention that, quote, the will to give ourselves to others and welcome them, to readjust our identities to make space for them, is prior to any judgment about others, except that of identifying them in their humanity. He concludes by saying, the will to embrace precedes any truth about others and any construction of their justice. And yet, Wolf seeks to resist the co-optation of his politics of embrace into the mainstream liberal politics of inclusivity. He clearly wants to avoid that sort of connection there, but more about that a bit later. At this point, however, I would like to introduce these wonderful young scholars who have become not only my students, my friends as well over the course of several years, and I'm so very grateful that they have agreed to join me today. All of them are former and current Thinking Theologically students. First to present will be Camden, who is double majoring in behavioral sciences and Spanish translation, and has set his eyes on pursuing a master's in international development. Isaiah here is a pre-med student, readying himself to take the MCAT this summer, and we certainly wish you all the best in this. It's such a joy to have him in my class at this very moment. Samantha, just an amazing young woman and student whose area of study is English, and upon graduating this May, she will commence with her PhD studies at UC Davis with full tuition waiver provided. And finally, we have none other than Sarah Gain. I could say a lot about Sarah. It was such a joy to have her as well, who as of this semester has transitioned to the seminary, right, and is pursuing her MA in systematic theology. So each one of them has selected one of the chapters in the book, and they will provide just a brief summary, and then perhaps an assessment of the book as a whole, and then depending on the time left, we will have a brief panel discussion, and afterwards I will have a couple of concluding remarks and critical questions that I wish to raise about the book. So Camden, without much ado, why don't you then take us into the chapter that you have selected?
All right, well, I mean, first off, as far as the book as a whole is concerned, Wolf for me just kind of opened up a lot about the meaning of forgiveness and what it is to have this sort of Christian embrace. You can almost kind of feel the tension when he talks about forgiveness and analyzing kind of the breakup of his homeland and the horrible things that happened and bringing himself to that point where he says, we have to embrace the other. His chapter on exclusion begins with a talk about this common perception that this last century and this current century, they're the centuries of constantly increasing inclusion. And Wolf just wants to kind of peel that back. He doesn't want to necessarily disagree with the contention that we have included more people, but he does question its premise. He questions whether the inclusion that we're doing is genuine, whether it's not actually just a more subtle form of exclusion. And in that way, he agrees with a lot of contemporary postmodern thinkers. Then he moves directly into a section on what he calls separating and binding. Which is sort of his counter to postmodern thinkers like Foucault and Derrida, and one of the biggest things he says about that is that these people want us to say everything's okay. They want us to go for this very inclusive system, but at best, what they're creating is sort of this primordial chaos where the universe started when God began to create. He separated things and bound them together. But what's important is that separating can't happen without the binding. Differentiation itself is not the enemy. It's the twisting of the differentiation and the binding. So he goes on to talk about four elements of what he terms exclusion. And those are, first, elimination. And the examples he uses of this are you know, the very potent examples of ethnic cleansing in the former Yugoslavia or Rwanda or the Holocaust. He says this is the most obvious thing that comes up, but it's possibly not the most common. It's just the clearest, it's the most painful when we see it. The second thing is assimilation. He says when we are forcing people to conform to our way of thinking, to our way of doing things, then that is also a form of exclusion. The third that he mentions is domination. And when he mentions domination, he especially talks about apartheid in South Africa, the caste system in India, or both legal and now more kind of societal segregation in the United States. This one is also a very easy one to see. It's kind of the legacy of colonialism. And the final and perhaps most insidious type of exclusion that he mentions is what he calls abandonment. And abandonment is when we distance ourselves from the suffering of other people. We refuse to see the side of the victim, and we put ourselves into sort of this belief in the world of inclusion, but only move in our own circles and say, oh, we're inclusive, but ignore the problems of the people that we should be including. After kind of laying out what exclusion is, the next thing that Wolf does is this was kind of the most difficult part of the chapter for me, because Wolf begins to question the innocence of the victim. And it really struck me as really strange when I first read this section of the chapter, but he said, you know, there's this sort of thing that happens when someone is victimized where sin and exclusion is created in them by the act that is done to them by the aggressor. And you have this sort of, it's impossible. Everyone is innocent in their own eyes. Everyone is the victim, but there's this escalation, this tension between them, and this fighting back and forth. And that kind of creates this world where we can't even figure out who the good and the bad guys are. And he finishes the chapter with the account of Cain and Abel, and kind of this analysis of Cain's murder of Abel. And God comes to Cain after Abel's sacrifice is accepted, and he kind of pleads with Cain, you need to control this thing that's within you. And in the end, Cain ends up killing his brother. And when God comes back to Cain, he tells Cain what was wrong. He punishes Cain, but at the same time, he also puts the mark on Cain to protect him from evil.
Okay. Thank you. Yes.
My chapter was on the chapter of embrace. It was the chapter following exclusion. And Wolf continues his exploration of exclusion and embrace, seeking on, I mean, we can understand with the four types of exclusion that Camden mentioned, we could clearly see and understand how exclusion is just very much a part of our world, our planet, and the way that things are done everywhere from government to all types of philosophy to even how we interact with each other, even in the home. We see this type, all sorts of different types of exclusion occurring. And so he's wondering, how can we combat this exclusion? How can we fight against this exclusion? And so he then articulates, he explains how humanity has tried to fight against this exclusion. And humanity has used this language of liberation, oppression and liberation. Oftentimes when we've been on both sides of exclusion, we have perpetrated exclusion and we have been the victimizers, and we have also been excluded. We are victims. And lots of the times what occurs is, as victims, we use this language of, oh, we are oppressed and we need to be liberated. And this language can only go so far, and he uses a really amazing and slightly extreme example, speaking of this Muslim woman who lived in Yugoslavia during the time of the war in Yugoslavia. And she had a son, and she named her son Jihad. And the first time that she breastfed her son, she told her son, I hope that you choke on my breast milk if you forget the things, the atrocities that happened to me. She was raped. She was raped. She was molested. It's described there, some of it's described in the horrible things that occurred to her. And she told her son, I hope that you choke on my breast milk if you don't forget. And named his very identity was Jihad. His very identity from that point was nothing but violence and revenge. And so this language of oppression and liberation, oftentimes it's not good for negotiating. It's not good for solving anything. All that it does is it repeats this cycle of violence and revenge and violence and revenge. And the second that a person is liberated from this oppression, they end up turning right around and then oppressing those that they were liberated from. And so the cycle just keeps continuing. And so he says the language that should be used is not that, but instead he kind of explains why he's using the language of exclusion and embrace. And he talks about what exactly does embrace look like. And he describes embrace because he wants people to understand that, yes, there's this kingdom of freedom where we all wish to be liberated from any and all forms of oppression. But the goal regarding Christianity, the goal of God is not simply just a kingdom of liberation, but it's a kingdom of liberation that leads towards a kingdom of love, a kingdom of embrace. Mm-hmm. And so and he describes this, and it's so strange for us because this is foreign to us. I mean, God showed this to us. The Lord God himself, he became man. Unto us a son was given, unto us a child was born. And he became man, and he did this type of embrace, and he embodied this type of embrace that was just amazing. It's something that we can't forget. It's totally foreign to the way that we operate. And so he explains that in order for us to be able to live this embrace, to fight against the exclusion and the oppression, he describes that first what must occur is that we must have a pure heart, because this is something that is totally foreign to us. And as Christians, we always say, you know, God is love. We forget the text that love itself is of God. We act as though You know, yeah, God's love, and love is just something that we could just do or operate. No, but love itself is from God, and a pure heart must be given to us. We can't really obtain this on our own. This is really a supernatural act. It's something that's really amazing. And he describes the act of forgiveness and how forgiveness is able. It's not that when you forgive, you're ignoring what occurred. As a matter of fact, forgiveness does something amazing. It upholds justice, because in order to forgive, you have to explicitly state the violence or the harm that has been done. And it's this interesting type of suffering, and it kind of like, it made the sufferings of Christ that Peter described, it kind of spoke to me. It was really different. Like, wow, in forgiving someone, I'm just choosing to just hold the damage that has been done to me, and I'm bearing it, but I'm making the space, and he describes the space that we are making in our heart for the other in order to embrace the other, in order to include the other. And this chapter and the book as a whole, it was just really amazing for me because it made Adventism become so amazing. It made Revelation become so amazing. As I saw, I could only think of that group from every nation, tribe, kindred, tongue, and people who have all done so much harm to each other, who have oppressed and who have been victimized, but yet they are of unity, yet they are one. And it just really made the Advent mission so much real to me, so much more real to me, and in the chapter of embracing and the book as a whole.
So. Thank you. Thanks a lot. Samantha.
All right. Well, when I first read this book in last semester, I particularly enjoyed it because it asks us to think very deeply about these incredibly exclusionary ideas that often permeate aspects of our lives we don't often consider. And as such, it's a call to action then to begin to think about the ways in which we exclude, the ways we might not even think about it. And it's also a call to action to practice embrace. And so as I read, I was profoundly impressed to examine even my own actions to begin to practice embrace. And so in the chapter on deception and truth, which comes a little later in the book, Wolf is discussing memory and truth and forgetting and forgiveness. And so when violence is enacted, we want to remember what really happened so that we will never practice it again. For example, the idea that we will never forget the Holocaust, we remember what happened, we remember the violence, and then we do not enact it again. And Wolf says this is a noble sentiment, and in doing so, in remembering what really happened, we refuse to conceal evil. So to forget past atrocities in some ways gives a pass card to those who have done the victimization and the evil. But in remembering the truth, we prevent further evil. Michel Foucault, a 20th century philosopher, he says that secrecy and forgetting is essential to the operation of power. However, Wolf is also troubling this idea of remembering and truth, because he asks, what are we really remembering? No memory, especially not a collective memory, is free from bias or perspective. Even as much as we try, memory is often faulty. And so he argues that we can never really remember what truly happened because we have no access to that. And this is where he begins to discuss Foucault's ideas of regimes of truth. A lot of us think, especially coming out of the modern age, that there is sort of an objective truth that we can reach, and it's quantifiably, you can get to it. However, Foucault argues that truth isn't objectively discovered. It's produced by those in power, it's manufactured, and it's named to function as truth. And so the truth produced by those in power works to support those in power as well. And so we have these fictions that we believe that are often very, very conducive to those who have a certain agenda. You're all familiar with the phrase, history is written by the victors. And in doing so, when the victors write history, they exclude a number of voices who also existed and had experiences. And so there's a partial truth, or perhaps not even any truth at all. So in the face of these productions of truth and our inability to know what really happened and then thus to prevent it, Wolf asks, well, what do we do? How can we escape these perspective memories? And he argues that only God can have truly perspective-free memory, but he advocates something called double vision, which is trying to see not just from our own perspective, but from the perspective of the other. And for me, this is a very interesting concept to think about, because how can we see as God sees? We are not God, we have fallible knowledge. But he gives four steps to kind of try to practice this. So first, we have to step outside our own knowledge, stepping into someone else's shoes, move into the realm of the other, and then bring them into our own knowledge. And this is a little problematic because it can often result in the stronger absorbing the weaker. But the way Wolf is arguing for it, it's we are trying to see from both perspectives, and we are including someone else's perspective in ours, no matter what the consequences of their perspective may be. And he talks about this thing called the will to truth. In order to discover truth and to succeed at this double vision, we must not only have the desire to access truth, but the desire to practice it. When you reach this truth of the other, you must also accept whatever inconvenient truths or negative consequences to your own bias that it produces. And so he ends the chapter by reminding us that truth also has a very important implication for Christians as well. Although Foucault argues that truth is produced by those in power, as Christians we claim to have the truth, but there's a very important difference here, that we don't produce the truth, we point to it as witnesses. And so the truth of God is not something that we're creating for our own ends, we're pointing others to it. And truth then, the Christian truth, has an active component that is vital to the functioning of the community.
Thank you, wonderful.
One thing that struck me very powerfully about this book was its autobiographical kind of this feel. You sense that Wolf is working through some of these issues in the actual writing of the book. And going through it, you know, he inserts these stories about his own experiences, experiences of others in Yugoslavia. And there's this sense of questioning and searching for the answers throughout the book. And to me, that was extremely powerful. And it comes through perhaps the most powerfully in the last chapter, which is entitled Violence and Peace. And here he takes all of these themes that he's been working with, that of exclusion, embrace, forgiveness, and they all come to the forefront in this discussion on violence. And the chapter can really be broken into two segments. First, the violence of people, and second, the violence of God. So what we see in Revelation. And in his first discussion of the violence of people, he demonstrates that Christians have a problem because we are living in a world that is under Caesar's sword. And because we are living in a world that is governed by worldly institutions that are violent, we are a peaceful people. We are trying to follow the way of Christ, and yet that directly opposes this other way of life. And that kind of opposition creates, in a way, violence. So what do we do? As Christians, we want to get away from violence, and yet at the same time, by being Christians, we are invoking kind of violence, if not actual physical violence, at least violence of ideologies. Then he goes through and he gives a survey of modern rational thought and how rational thought has actually helped to promote a way of doing violence that dehumanizes the enemy. And he says that modern thought made the Holocaust possible, made genocide in Rwanda possible. When we are, you know, carrying out airstrikes with drones, people cease to be casualties. They are targets. They are falling by the sidelines. It's kind of like a oops. Well, you know, what can we do? You know, we're in a war. But they're using drones. They're using machines to do it. And there's not that human on the other side that is seeing things blow up and seeing the fire and seeing the pain in people's eyes. And so it takes away that human aspect, and we lose the reality of pain. And that's a very problematic thing. Through civilization, we have become uncivilized, is basically what he's saying. Wolf then asserts that it's not people's religions that are at war with each other, it is the people that are at war, and that as long as we are at war with each other, our religions can never be at peace. You know, it's not that our gods are angry with each other and that they're commanding us to go to war. That's not it at all. It's that we are mad at each other. And so he says, you know, there will be no peace until it is understood that it's never okay to use religion as a sanction for violence. Then he goes into a discussion of the violence of God and Revelation. Who is this wrathful God that we see in the Bible? how does he fit in with the character of Jesus Christ? Why is God riding on a white horse with this sword in his hand? I mean, this is a very powerful image that we see, and it troubles some people. It troubles a man by the name of Gilles Deleuze, and he has this theory that heaven is a kind of totalitarian state in which, in order to have peace, the entire world must be taken over by this kind of totalitarian regime. And, you know, in order for peace to happen, there is first complete and total destruction, which is, you know, doesn't make sense. It's an oxymoron. And he questions, you know, how is it that the destruction of evil is viewed as some kind of act of peace on the part of God? How can God destroy evil and that not be an evil act? Is not the very notion of destruction evil? And then he states something very important. It's the cross that is the answer to all of that. The cross is the answer to Revelation, because it is in the cross that God surrenders himself, takes on all of that violence, and subverts this cycle of violence that we've been dealing with throughout this entire book. The judgment of the world happens through a suffering God. The only way that judgment can occur is for God himself to experience the suffering. Only a fair and just God who has suffered as we have, who has suffered taking on all of this sin and garbage onto himself, can then give a judgment. And he deals with this through the end of the chapter, and then it's almost as if there's like this open end. He stops. And he just leaves you hanging. And I read the chapter and I was like, wait, what? That's it? You know, there's nothing more? But I think that this is the autobiographical aspect of it. There is so much more that we don't know. There's so much more that when we get to Revelation, we just don't understand. And so that's where he leaves us.
Well, thank you very much for this outstanding, I think, summary of some of the themes in the book. And we just have a couple of minutes, perhaps. I think the easiest way would be just for me just to go start with you, Camden, and then go down here. And then later on, we'll have more like a free-flowing, perhaps, conversation. I want to go back, Camden, to this thing that, as you know, plagues me as well very much, this notion that there are no innocence. And it seemed to me that in a context where someone has been violated or wronged in any sense, and for me now to say, oh yes, but you are also not innocent, seems to be almost to nullify or minimize the wrong committed. Mm-hmm. How is Wolf dealing with that? Why does he want to stress that?
Yeah, Wolf actually spends a lot of time on this, and yeah. I had to hit everything about the same amount of time.
Yeah.
But one thing that he mentions is that he does not believe in this idea of all sin being equal. And so when he says that there is sin created in the victim, he's by no means saying that there is this like equal reaction that say if someone is raped, that they've done something just as wrong as the person that's raped them. No, like he doesn't want to say that at all. Mm-hmm. What he is trying to say is that there's just this kind of part of the human heart, this kind of systematic, when evil is done to us, that creates hatred. And it's very difficult for us to avoid contributing to the problem and that resentment. And he actually engages Friedrich Nietzsche mm-hmm. on that part and talks about Nietzsche's idea of ressentiment, mm-hmm. this sort of submitting but being resentful and this passive playing up of the victimization and trying to use weaker means to overcome a stronger opponent. It's not so much that no one is a victim. Wolf doesn't believe that at all, and he believes that justice needs to be had. But it's just this idea that evil is so widespread.
Right. So it seems to me that in some way he tries to take seriously the Paul's statement, right, that all of us have sinned and lost the glory of God, and how does that operate in the ethical sphere once we talk about forgiveness? Excellent point. Isaiah, perhaps, I mean, he's kind of discussing this issue of forgiveness and justice, right? And he makes the claim that forgiveness means letting go of justice on the one hand, and yet on the other hand, he seems to say, no, forgiveness and justice have to be together. So how does he negotiate those two different claims?
Right, and so lots of times we think of justice, we think of what's called retributive justice,
Yes. Where
basically if a wrong's been done to you, you give the same wrong back, eye for an eye and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And so that retributive justice, what he's talking about is when you're embracing and when you're forgiving, that retributive justice, you have to throw that out the window. Mm-hmm. You will not be able to pay the person back with the same deed that they have given you. Mm-hmm. And yet, justice as a whole is not thrown out the window, because part of justice is naming that thing for what it is. I think all of us experience, like, you know, when someone wrongs us, it's not that we want them exactly to, you know, suffer. We just want them to be honest with what they did. Just admit to the fact that, yeah, you did this. Don't be in denial about it. And that brings some sort of healing. Mm-hmm. But the retributive justice, it cannot occur and it will not occur as far as forgiveness goes. But yet there is a part of justice when that thing is named and it actually uphold, it's kind of like, you know, as Adventists, we look at the fact that, no, God's not, the cross is not saying that God abolished his law. No, the cross is saying that I will not abolish my law, and because of that, I will actually pay the full penalty, which is death. The law is not thrown out the window. No, the law is actually still kept up there, so much so that God, he follows the way that it's supposed to go, and God takes our death upon himself.
Right.
And so
that's why he stresses this notion, right, that the very concept of forgiveness implies the apportioning of blame. Hmm. If there's no blame, there's no forgiveness.
Right.
And he tries to hold these things very much together. Samantha, I mean, when Wolf is sort of being critical both of modernity and postmodern thought throughout his book, and I'm wondering, since you have been doing in your wonderful, wonderful honors thesis project, some work on Foucault, one of the prominent postmodern thinkers. I'm wondering how does Wolf deal with postmodernism or postmodern thought specifically in this book? Is he affirming it, rejecting it? How is he dealing with that?
Okay, the way I understand Wolf, his approach to postmodernism is a two-pronged approach. And I think very, very quickly, he believes postmodernism is right in its assessment of modern culture. For example, I mentioned Foucault says that truth is produced by those in power. There are people actively trying to convince us of a certain truth or that fits their agenda. But at the same time, I'll speak very loudly. But at the same time,
thank you. So Wolf says that postmodernism is correct in its analysis of today's age. It understands the workings of power. It can see beyond what is presented, as Foucault talks about. But at the same time, he also discusses the kind of claim in postmodernism that it provides a more inclusive way of living. There's an idea in postmodernism that we can no longer think in binaries. There is no black and white. Those are both charged terms. And so we must erase those terms. But in doing so, there's no sort of definition and foundation at all. So whereas postmodernism claims that we have, you know, more inclusion and a growing amount of people inside our embrace, there's actually no foundation at all, and we have nothing to grasp onto, and we're all floating in this purposeless void. And so Wolf both uses and critiques postmodernism to further his analysis.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you so much. Finally, Sarah, I mean, when we look at contemporary critiques of religion, and as we've stated in class many times, that they can be basically summarized under two headings, right? Either religion is stupid or religion is dangerous. And when we look at dangerous, we see, for example, that sometimes religion qua religion as religion, is being rejected. Sometimes it's monotheism, sometimes it's the doctrine of creation. But very often we have this notion sort of eschatological violence being critiqued. In other words, you believe in something like the book of Revelation and you will eventually end up blowing up abortion clinics, right? Mm-hmm. So how does Wolf address this by actually referring to both the Psalms in one place, imprecatory psalms, and then also to the Anabaptists
and how they deal with that.
Yeah. Perhaps,
This is actually in my notes. I'm glad you asked the question.
Yeah.
Something very interesting actually very pertinent to this. There's a fantastic quote in the chapter, which I'd like to just share quickly. This is what he writes. This is page 304. Yeah. He says, so he's talking about nonviolence, which I'll get to in a minute. He says, you would discover that it takes the quiet of a suburban home for the birth of the thesis that human nonviolence corresponds to God's refusal to judge. I'll read that again just so you really get it. You would discover that it takes the quiet of a suburban home for the birth of the thesis that human nonviolence corresponds to God's refusal to judge. It is scorched land soaked in the blood of the innocent. It will invariably die. And as one watches it die, one will do well to reflect about many other pleasant captivities of the liberal mind. And he states that the people who have the least problem with wrathful, vengeful God are the Anabaptists, which is very interesting because, of course, they have this long tradition of nonviolence. So why is that? You know, if they're nonviolent, why are they okay with this violent God? And the reason is they believe that God is the only one who is able to judge. And he's the only one who's able to judge fairly, precisely because of the reason that, number one, he's God. Number two, he sent his son to die on the cross and has experienced injustice himself. He has taken the sin of the world. He has done everything that he possibly can. And the problem is not with those who, the problem is with those who refuse to accept that open embrace. By those who are not willing to, you know, go through this open door that God has given, they are doing a violent act, and they simply cannot exist in God's presence. And, you know, if we didn't have this indignant, angry, wrathful God in Revelation, then he would be a party to all of the crimes that are committed here on earth. Because how can you watch somebody being killed? How can you watch a child being killed and not be angry? You have to be angry. And so this indignation, righteous, terrible fury that we see in Revelation is completely and totally necessary, and the Anabaptists get that. And Wolf goes on to say, if you do not accept nonviolence, basically, then there is obviously something wrong with your understanding of God as judge. Because if you feel the need to go out and judge the world with violence, if you feel the need to go out there and be the one to enforce the law, then you obviously do not believe that God is capable of doing it himself.
Beautifully put. I'm sure we'll have some more questions on this. So let me just conclude this part of our sort of presentation with a couple of more formal remarks, and then we'll have a Q&A session, if that's okay. So let me say that much of what Professor Wolf suggests in his different writings, quite frankly, doesn't make a lot of sense, humanly speaking, that is. That I should forgive those who don't seek such forgiveness, that I should embrace those with whom I have nothing in common, that I should expect healing of hurtful memories that have so fundamentally shaped my identity, that my abusers deserve to be my interlocutors, that I should love even those who wish my non-being. Such ideas are simply preposterous. Wolf, of course, is aware of this as well as anyone else, and it is that awareness that shapes his delineation and understanding of the theological task, one that rests on a rhetoric of radical sort of conversion that he expects from us. He directs our gaze to those practices of the Christian faith that make no sense unless we really believe that God exists. It is precisely at the moment when I say, oh, that's not possible, or I could never do that, that my residual doubts and suppressed unbelief about what drives history and who is in control are being uncovered. Such realization is no small feat, as it is in this encounter with the scandalous nature of the Christian faith that really, when I understand that I cannot do it, that seeds of redemption are being sown. And Wolf is constantly reminding me of this and pushing me to take the implications of the cross seriously, and for that I am deeply, deeply, profoundly grateful. That being said, I have several reservations about the book, which, due to a lack of time, I cannot fully explore here. For one, I feel uneasy to criticize a work that you might not have read, right? And so cannot take me to task to further justify my points of disputation. Furthermore, I'm not well aware that not everything can be addressed in one monograph, and that Wolf has further refined his ideas in different settings. But be that as it may, here are a couple of, not so much criticisms perhaps, but areas for further dialogue. First, I'm puzzled by Wolf's neglect to articulate the kind of human agency necessary to sustain a coherent embodiment of his vision. Okay, so I need to embrace, but how? How do I become that sort of a person that is able to live out such an ethics of embrace? What forms of ascesis or self-crafting, self-transformation are being implied here? What set of virtues and forms of practical rationality do I need to possess in order to rightly see, reason, and act? How are they acquired and nurtured? I think these questions are quite essential because, as William Schweiker rightly suggests, quote, norms and goods are morally relevant, exhortations are morally irrelevant if agents cannot live by them. And I just don't see Wolf adequately addressing that essential dimension of moral responsibility, the one by which we are crafted as moral agents, one that any ethical theory must account for. Second, as I think Sarah intimated a little bit, I find the sudden fallback to an unarticulated just war position on the last pages of his book to be disappointingly undernourished. Following all the declamations of embrace that we have throughout the course of the book, we are unexpectedly being told that such an ethics of nonviolence might in fact not be realizable in a fallen world. Now, he might be right on that count, but such a recourse to a quote-unquote realistic perspective needs to be fleshed out a little bit more. What is missing here are evaluative criteria and rules one is to employ in order to decide why the given suspension might be needed. Furthermore, his argument that Christians, when consenting to the legitimacy of particular acts of violence, such as tyrannicide, should not evoke God as the grand legitimator is actually somewhat odd. After all, when I, as a Christian, argue, hypothetically speaking, that my ethic of nonviolence should be suspended under such and such circumstances, I'm presumably implying that doing so is warranted on account of certain theological beliefs and assessments, such as the reality of evil, the nature of human good, the need for solidarity with others, and so on and so forth. If I'm not to evoke God, if I'm not to draw on a theological frame of reference in deciding when violence might be necessary, then what else? Some other neutral ground of justification, perhaps. It seems to me, therefore, that Wolf's position in an attempt to guard against religious legitimations of violence unwittingly invites a pernicious dualism of moral reasoning that cordons off a segment of reality from the lordship of Jesus Christ. Third, and this is this whole thing about his vigorous defense of divine violence, and I just realized today that some of you know Sigve Tonstad, right, who is a professor at Loma Linda University, and he's on campus, and I'm so sorry he couldn't be here today, because I think he very much disagrees with Wolf's defense of divine violence. For someone like him, Tonstad, the imputation of retributive justice and violence unto God is being demonic in character, he would say. In fact, in a private conversation that I had with him, he referred to Wolf as someone who just doesn't get it, and he doesn't get it because he doesn't know about the great controversy, and he's operating more from sort of a Calvinistic understanding of history that only sees one agent working instead of multiple different agents. Anyway, that's one possible thing. And finally, there is one additional issue of great pertinence for the Adventist Church today, and anyone who has listened to Dwight's sermons, Pastor Nelson's sermons the last couple of Sabbaths will readily notice this. Throughout the book, Wolf stresses that identities must be distinct. That if you don't have distinct boundaries, including forms of adjudication or judgments, by which you say this but not that, you don't have identities. In fact, as Wolf contends, it is a very good thing that boundaries exist. level all the boundaries, and what you get really is not a world that we can inhabit, but as he puts it, a dense pond of sheer indistinguishables. A world without personhood, causes, projects, passions, dreams, right? So Wolf recognizes this and therefore tries to provide an account of what he calls non-exclusionary judgments. In other words, he wants to establish certain grammatical rules, so to speak, by which we can affirm identity, state who we are and what we are about, but to do so in a way that does not demonize the other. As he puts it, and I think that's a very important quote in his book, intelligent struggle against exclusion, if we want to struggle against exclusion, that demands categories and normative criteria that enable us to distinguish between repressive identities and practices that should be subverted and non-repressive ones that should be affirmed. I believe that Wolf is pressing here, implicitly so, against a certain approach to Adventist pluralism that a good number of Adventists might find congenial, right? And so his proposal sort of challenges us to be critical of tendencies to extol Adventist pluralism in a sort of unrestrained and eventually perhaps even irresponsible sort of way. Wouldn't a cavalier advocating of plurality for the sake of plurality assure at some point the church's complicity with the ideological blind spots of a given age? After all, not all forms of growth and plurality can be summed up under the discourse of kaleidoscopic richness and multiplicity of meanings. Some mutations and some versions of plurality are simply pathological. Failing to understand that would entail a denial of the church's calling to be a sign of the kingdom of God, a kingdom that has a specific shape, a specific content, a specific message about, well, this but not that, and thus comes, and yes, this needs to be said, in the shape of God's judgment against all forms of idolatry. In that sense, the parroted, often parroted phrase that liberals need conservatives and that leftists need to fundamentalists and vice versa, social activists and last generationists in our midst need each other, and that plurality contributes to the enrichment of the whole can only go so far. At some point, you seriously begin to strain the principle of non-contradiction, one that can hardly be wished away by ever more passionate appeals to compassion and inclusion. In Wolf's words, it must be recognized that, comma, they are incommensurable, incompatible perspectives that stubbornly refuse to be dissolved into a peaceful synthesis. Clearly, his proposal raises a whole bevy of questions, not least of which are the following, and this is my concluding paragraph here. How is it supposed to work on the ground, as it were? What is one to do in a community of faith where those boundaries are hotly contested, where the terms of the debate, the composition of authoritative voices, the nature and content of the confessional core are themselves subject to pluralistic disagreements? What are the mechanisms by which this is supposed to be negotiated? What conditions satisfy the requirement of non-exclusion? Does embrace only take place once all interested parties can affirm it? How would we fare in answering these questions if we turn to an emotionally charged test case such as the issue of homosexuality and the church? Can you have the visibility of the church without the language of anathema? In other words, the language by which you say this yes, but this not. And if you don't have procedures of belonging. Unfortunately, Wolf doesn't offer much guidance in this connection. And yet I consider these questions to be of incredible importance, as current debates in the Adventist faith community are never simply discussions about doctrinal matters, but also more fundamentally about such issues of identity and differentiation. That is, they are questions about what it means to be the church, or to quote Dietrich Bonhoeffer, what it means to be, quote, the presence of God in the world. Thank you.
Okay. Questions? Better think of some, otherwise we go right to the test. I don't want that.
Yeah, the definitions need to have little numbers on them. Whenever we use a term like inclusion or pluralism, it ought to be pluralism 1, pluralism 2, down maybe even as far as 10. I haven't read the book, but as I heard everybody talk, I became more and more interested in the question of epistemology. It seems to me that I really don't know what the author's position is vis-a-vis postmodernism, really. Is modernism 1, 2? It looks to me like if we assume that knowledge is culturally based, we can simplistically then go on and say that anything goes, because culture is what it is. It's just one culture differing from another. And that is the question then that we allow anybody's epistemology to govern that system of thought that produces literature and whatever other means of communication that that society or that culture produces. I have a question about that. It seems to me like that whether we're in the modern world or in the postmodern world, that there are two kinds of scholars and two kinds of advocates or medium propagandists, and that is one that's full of hubris and the other that is full of humility. In other words, a postmodernist, are they full of hubris or are they full of humility? And a particle scientist that says, like Weinberg, that to be truly evil, you must be religious. You know, a good person doesn't have to be religious, and a religious person doesn't have to be bad, but to be truly evil, that takes religion, something like that. That sounds like it's full of hubris and not much humility. And when Foucault and other postmodernists give you the impression that science, for instance, is just another point of view because it's culturally based, the culture needs a number by it. Are we talking about Weinberg's culture, or are we talking about some other scientist culture that basically sees reality as full of wonder and unanswered questions and ineffability? When this comes down to the non-hard scientific structures and materials, which you're talking about, theology, philosophy, how do we solve cultural issues, how do we solve questions of justice, those are profoundly difficult. If most of the mass murderers that we've heard about, when they had autopsies done of them, were found to have malformations in the brain, even brain tumors, and that was the cause of their maliciousness and their viciousness, how are we going to insist on justice? When somebody who is of a group of people commits an act and we try to hold them guilty for it or responsible for it, are we talking about individual responsibility or corporate guilt, corporate responsibility? It seems to me that if I, as an American, am punished for not becoming involved in maybe the question of Monsanto's patenting of all the seed corn in India, does somebody in India have the right to come and kill me or put me in jail or starve me to death or maybe just starve me a little bit because I didn't say anything about that? back in the day when the civil rights movement was going on, there were people who said that if you were not out there, we were in the seminary, but if you were not out there with Martin Luther King, you were corporately as guilty as those Southerners that were trying to stop the civil rights movement. Those are the questions I think that, I don't know whether your author answers those, but somebody can speak to that if they will.
I remember when I took...
You just took care of the next 10 questions, yeah. Joe.
I remember when I took my oral exam and my professor asked me a question. It took him about 5 minutes to frame it, and then I said, "Can you repeat this?" And then I think it's a multi-layer. You're raising so many questions, and if I can just pick one element of it, and might not be able to do justice to what you're asking, then perhaps ask some of my colleagues here. I think that in terms of how we understand postmodernism in terms of epistemology, it really depends, as you say, I mean, you can view it both ways. If you follow sort of, the line that was developed by Martin Heidegger, who, when he reads Nietzsche and he says, no, Nietzsche, you're not really about humility and critiquing everything, you're basically postulating another big metaphysics. You're actually the apex of hubris that you supposedly are criticizing. And some people like John Milbanken today are actually reading postmodernism like that. It seems to me in this book, though, that Wolf is not directly engaging questions of epistemology in this kind of abstract sense. He's picking a couple of authors and then engaging them on specific points. And the way he's positioning modernity and postmodernity is he would use modernity as this exemplification of humor, of hubris and pride, and then see the negative consequences of this. And then when he talks about postmodernism, he will more emphasize this sort of quote-unquote humility side that has its negative effects because it leads to moral paralysis or inability to act. Because one acts, after reading Foucault, you ask yourself, what, if you believe what Foucault is saying, the way he describes power, how can one ever act in any intelligible way? So I think what he wants to do is, as Samantha beautifully put it, he wants to use this sort of postmodernism in terms of kind of having, recognizing that our knowledge is always socially conditioned, but he wants to chart a thing, an in-between path between modernity and postmodernity. And I know I'm not answering your question, but at least these are some of the aspects. Anything else that you guys want to perhaps add here?
I think as far as the genre of the book is concerned and the way he's going about writing it, it's, at least in my mind, far less philosophical than it is anthropological. Yeah. He's dealing with the nature of humanity and how we react to violence, how we react to things that are done to us, how we forgive, this kind of thing. So these kind of philosophical themes that run throughout the book are important, but they're definitely not the center of the book, at least in my opinion. Epistemology is not as important to him as working through these big questions of things like theodicy and forgiveness. Postmodernism and modernism are used, as Dr. Jurandrich said, kind of examples. He will critique something here and there. He will say, okay, this is kind of part of the reason why we think this way towards something is because of this postmodern philosopher or because of this postmodern trend or this modern trend or something like that. That's kind of how he's using it. It's less of a, you know, let me critique postmodernism or something like that. His approach is very anthropological. Why do we have this problem? What do we do about it? What do we specifically as Christians do about it?
But it's also theological.
How
do you embrace someone who has murdered your parents, to make it sort of specific? I mean, that's it involves all these other things, but that's a profoundly spiritual, theological question. And that's what he opens the books with. That sort of question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, there's a in the preface to the book, actually, it's funny that you said how do you embrace someone who murdered your parents, because there's this section, and I can't remember all the details of it, and I don't think that I can read the whole thing, but Wolf did a lecture, and he says that at the end of the lecture, Jürgen Moltmann stood up and said, "But can you embrace a Chetnik?" Mm-hmm. Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah.
Which is essentially a Serbian militia fighter. These people that went out and killed kind of indiscriminately, and Wolf's response was really interesting because he says right here, it's on page 9 of the book, "No, I cannot. But as a follower of Christ, I think I should be able to." And so I think that Wolf is recognizing too this tension between our feelings and how we want things to be and how we really do need to act.
Can you trust a guy who doesn't go by Wolf and changes it to Wolf?
I'm a social worker. I'm a social worker, and so I like to see how ideas get played out in practical ways in the real world. And one of the somewhat recent ways of dealing with the whole issue of justice in the real world is restorative justice. And I don't know if that's ever been described in Wolf's book, or if that's part of the way in which this gets played out in the real world. But I mean, one of the amazing things I think about restorative justice, which is originally, I think, conceptualized by Mark Umbright up in University of Minnesota. He's actually a Mennonite. I don't know if he's a sociologist or I don't know what his background is, but you know, the core of it is that justice must be served, but justice first has to acknowledge truth. In the way that I think Wolf is describing. And so the accuser and the accused must come together. And the accused first must state what has happened. They must describe the crime or the experience that's occurred. And then the accused must face them, listen to them, and the hope is that there will be an acknowledgement, first of all, that they did that, that it's not a faceless crime, it's not a faceless activity, it's something that was done to someone, and that there's an empathetic response that perhaps will be triggered. And then as a result, there will be some sort of decision that's made, usually by a group of individuals who are listening to this process, about a community reconciliation. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the individual that has been the perpetrator, you know, says, "Oh, I'm so sorry," and they give a big hug and they walk out and everything's fine. There's still some sort of a justice that's done. But it often has to do with reaching out and doing some sort of reconciliation or remediation to the victim, and then having some sort of further activity that's done within the community to try and humanize it, but identifying and then critiquing and then trying to reconcile while still having justice.
Yeah. I mean, and obviously one wonderful historical example of that is South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And actually, Debbie and I, we lived in South Africa during that time, and that was such a powerful example. And I think Wolf exactly wants to articulate what you're saying right now. And he is touching on this in this book, but actually he has a follow-up book called The End of Memory. And sort of the title of the book has sort of a double play to it. The End of Memory as in telos, right? What's the purpose of remembering? And then the end as in terminus. When can we let go? And really specifying the things that you mentioned, the importance of, I think some of them, I think you might have mentioned, is the responsibility to remember truthfully, right? And not to try to pile up other things on top of it. And then also this element, how the element of naming is so essential, right? And the reason why Wolf looks forward to the judgment of God is precisely because he sees it as an event at which this naming is going to take place. All these silent voices that never received justice that will take place. In terms of, so he operates on that thing. Now, of course, Anabaptist and Mennonite theologians who try to promote a nonviolent a version of nonviolent atonement, they are chastising Wolf for not having sort of extended that to his image of God and the judgment of God and eventually his understanding of atonement. But that is another problem here. So I think you basically have summarized exactly what he is articulating, especially in that second book, in a wonderful way. And there are many, I would encourage, sometimes I show to my students, the wonderful brief clips on YouTube where he is very lucidly articulating what you have just stated, and it's very nice.
Can I just add one small thing, and that is, I think that's where the last chapter comes in and plays such an important role, because when you have the opportunity to have that kind of reconciliation, it's beautiful and it's wonderful. But some people never receive that. And some people are victims of, you know, this kind of sociopathic violence where there simply is no compassion and there's no remorse on the side of the perpetrator. You know, and what do you do when there's like an entire kind of a corporate level of sociopaths going out and killing a whole group of people? You know, what do you as the victim do? And I think that's part of the reason why Wolf brings up this topic of the judgment and of God as the judge and as also the one who experiences and takes on all of our pain. And for me in particular, you know, reading the imprecatory Psalms and seeing how David reacted to, you know, rather than taking out justice in his own way, which he could have done on a number of times, you know, he instead turns to God and vents all of this pent-up anger, you know. And I think that is a very powerful way of approaching your own kind of resolution. Even if you cannot have resolution with the other person, to have resolution between you and God, at least you're halfway there. You know, even if you are never to see that judgment until the judgment day, at least you know that it's there, and that is some comfort.
Yeah, I think this is partly the interesting that this gentleman from the former Yugoslavia, the trouble and the problems serve as a kind of good laboratory to explore these ideas, because whole groups went against whole groups, but we in America seem to have missed a lot of this. We still Yugoslavia to us.
And he has very beautiful examples. He has these horrible examples that you mentioned, but he has this great example of this Franciscan priest who went to visit a home that was taken over, I mean, since all of this reconfiguration took place in Bosnia, right? And it was inhabited by a Muslim family now, and the home belonged to the brother of this Franciscan priest. And so he comes closer to this home, and this Muslim woman comes out with a gun, and she wants to shoot him, go away, this is not my house. And so she tells him, I'm going to shoot you now. And he says, no, you're going to make me coffee, right? And she looks at him, really? Yeah, you're going to make me coffee. And coffee is like a big thing, obviously, there. And then she invited him, and they had a conversation. So you have these very small, minor, insignificant, symbolic acts, but that can have an enormous sort of power to bridge some of these gaps. So it's,
several things. Incidentally, as far as the getting an environment for where this person lived, anybody wants to see a movie shot through the heart, It's an incredible movie that's set in there. I have several things here that I thought of. These are certainly not answers, although there are some of the thoughts that I've had related to this. A victim becoming a participant in the problem or a part of the problem. I think that they become a part of the problem when they do not engage in forgiveness and at giving absolution. They have a choice. When something happens, how do I relate to it? We can't choose what happens, but we can't choose how we relate. And some will say, well, it's not rational to give absolution. Although I've been reading Acts chapter 7 and Stephen, when they were stoning him, he gave immediate absolution. and I think he did not experience this. And so you have a choice of either giving absolution or doing blame. And that, to that extent, I think the victim does become part of the problem. The idea here of religion being stupid or dangerous that you brought up, Sarah, I think that that's probably correct, because as I see religion, religion is basically the gospel with politics hooked on. And whenever you hook politics onto anything, it gets stupid and dangerous. So I see Wolf here basically, it seems to me, to be an apologist for religion. And I myself personally, I grew up as a Seventh-day Adventist, and I bailed out 25 years ago. And my current thinking is that the Holy Spirit attempts to access us through our mind, and the devil manages us through our culture. And I think that this here is basically what you're talking about.
Thank you. Thank you. Perhaps just as we go, I think you put it beautifully. I think when he says this statement, there are no innocent victims, right? As you put it, I think a way to translate this is to say what he means by this is that in the process of reconciliation, we have to sort of readdress our identity. And our identity can only be properly defined and understood, as Sarah put it, in the light of the cross, in the light of God's acts of liberation. And I think so what he wants therefore to say is before you start, before you even begin to address these breaches of relationship, you have to go back and say, well, who am I actually? And it is the cross that tells you who you are. And so positioning myself within these, what he calls regulative memories, these major memories of accounts of the Bible is a very important process of this act of embrace that's happening. So you're absolutely right.
Yeah, I think the phrase that strikes me is, he says, both the oppressor and the oppressed need the grace of God.
Absolutely.
Repentance.
To go on what your first point, and you were talking about how we logically try to reason through when we're victims on how we're supposed to react. And he actually talks about that in his opening chapter of Embrace. And quote, he says, there is no choice, says the man from Sarajevo, echoing the inner logic of exclusionary polarities. But is he right? Is the inner logic of exclusionary polarities irresistible? There may indeed be situations in which there is no choice, though we should not forget that to destroy the other rather than to be destroyed oneself is itself a choice. And so automatically we take the survival instinct where we think, oh, like there's no choice. I must always be protected at any cost. And forgiveness is that's why it's not instinctive for us, because automatically, logically, I must survive. That's what we always, above everything, that's what we,
Could forgiveness be done in advance instead of in arrears? And if we chose to do so, think about the implications of that.
Right. And I think
Jesus did that.
Right. And that, I think that's why it's so amazing how when Christ describes our relationship with him, it's not so much that we go out and we just try to represent God. It's that no, and when we're home, when we wake up in the beginning of the day, we really feel God's embrace. The victim and the victimized, we really feel God's embrace. And so, God's embrace and God's forgiveness. And when we go out about our day, it'll be already, because I am forgiven, I am forgiving others. I am loving others because he first has loved me. It's a very applicable thing. And because it's not at all instinctive. Natural instinct is to protect myself. I am number one. But when we see the grace of God and we see that God has given everything for me, knowing that I might not even accept him, something like that, and that forgiveness, that's powerful enough for us to be forgiving people, us to truly be embracing people. It's totally possible, and that is what is to happen with us.
I was ombudswoman, I guess, for the university for about 10 years. And during that time, I had two experiences that some of our discussion or your presentations today brought back to my mind. They both had to do with an individual coming to see me about a wrong that they perceived that somebody else had done. One was a student who felt that an employee of one of our businesses of the university had targeted him or her and had really caused them shame. Although there were no words that were exchanged. And she said that, and so as I usually did with my clients that would come, I said, what would you like me to do? Because, you know, I could say, well, I'll do this and this and this, but I wanted to know what I could do for them that would help to resolve this. And she said, all I'd like is an apology. And so I said, okay, I'll go and talk to the individual. And I went and talked to the individual, and I said, this is how this student perceived it. And the person said, no, I wasn't following her around the store. I was just doing my work. And I said, well, you know, she has perceived it as if you were following her around the store, perhaps thinking she might take something. Well, that's her problem, not my problem. So, you know, I talked a little bit more. I said, wait, I agree with you that when we haven't done something and somebody else perceives it as that we've done that, that we're not guilty. But the thing is, can you bring yourself to say to the person, I'm sorry if you perceived it that way? That wasn't what my, those weren't my actions, that wasn't a purpose of my actions. And I feel bad that you have perceived it that way, and, you know, I'd like to say I'm sorry or forgive me. And there was no way that I could get that person to go and talk to the student, yeah, to just say, I'm sorry that you perceived it that way. I'm sorry if you feel bad, but that's not what I intended. I only had one other case which was similar, and this was between, and we're, as being a faculty member here for more than 30 years, it's, we're all human and we all make mistakes. But this was between two individuals, and things escalated, and so when the one person came and asked me to come visit in his or her home, and we talked. And so I said, well, what would you like me to do? And again, the request was that the person apologize. So I went to the other person on the staff, and I explained the situation, and I said, would you be willing to go and talk to the person and see if maybe you, the two of you, could come to a mutual understanding, or at least say, I'm sorry that you took it that way. That wasn't what I intended. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't successful. Mm-hmm. Those were the only two cases. And when I was never able to get somebody to go and ask for forgiveness for something which they hadn't done, or certainly what they hadn't intended, but which had been taken as an offense. Yeah. And I'm just wondering what you think about what would Volk say in terms of that kind of forgiveness.
That's quite interesting, because we a moment ago we said that the naming of the wrong seems to be essential to this process of forgiveness. And I may state this example, when my wife and I have an interesting conversation about something, and at the end of the conversation, she says, "I forgive you," I lose it. I don't want to be forgiven, because it means then I'm the one who is wrong. So because forgiveness always implies that the naming of something. Now, what you are saying is a very interesting thing, that some sort of reconciliation needs to happen without actually being able to name that thing, right? It's quite possible that that person didn't do anything. So how can I say, forgive me for that action when I'm not wrong? So I think that, I don't know what Wolf would say. He would probably say that in an effort to achieve reconciliation, we have to understand that we live in a broken world in which our actions and words might be misconstrued. And we have to have humility, both of us, to recognize that might have happened, and then actually be willing to let go of that naming in the name of
Exactly.
I cannot really say I apologize for that, because I haven't done anything wrong. But let's talk about it. We can have a conversation and see. But again, what Wolf would say, for reconciliation and embrace to happen, even in that situation, some sort of letting go of some sort of rights needs to take place. Because forgiveness is always about letting go of rights, always. Because you never ever can have the thing be returned to you completely. So already that very notion is implied there. So in a situation like that, he would simply, I think, extend it to that. That's what I think. Okay.
Can I add something? Well, I think this is a case where Wolf's concept of double vision is really important, because for these cases where, you know, you feel you've not wronged someone, that ability to go stand in their shoes and look back and say, oh, wow, I guess I can see how it would have been taken that way. Mm-hmm. And then you can make the apology on that common ground of, well, you know, maybe what I did was not wrong, my intentions were pure, but perhaps it was insensitive. Mm-hmm. Or perhaps I wasn't being careful about how I was making other people feel. Because we can wrong people completely unintentionally, and that doesn't mean it's necessarily our fault, but it also doesn't mean that there's no apology needed.
Don't you wish you could take Dr. Jurancic's class now? What's that? Sorry. But we thank all four of our students. Let's thank them for this wonderful conversation.